Good morning and welcome. I'm Robin Ayoub and this is the Localization Fireside Chat. Episode 217 today, and this one covers a lot of ground. My guest is Simon Hodgkins, Chief Marketing Officer of Vistatech, one of the most world-recognized global companies in content solution providers, headquartered in Dublin and serving the iconic brands that you all familiar with worldwide for nearly 30 years. But Simon is not just a CMO. I was reading his achievement. He made me feel underachiever. Like, I still have a lot to catch up to you, Simon. But he's not just a CMO. He has built an entire ecosystem around globalization. Think, you know, of all the initiatives that Simon has built, and I'm going to name a few of them here, and I'm sure I'm missing a few. The Think Global Forum, the Think Global Award, Vista Talk, VTQ Magazine, and the Global AI Brief. Here today, we are going to be talking about AI and localization, where it actually works and where it falls apart, and what responsible AI look like in a regulated environment like life sciences, government, etc., and what it means to build a brand that goes far beyond the company you work for. If you are in the language industry, which I'm assuming most of you guys out there listening to this podcast and joining me on this journey today are. And if you are intrigued or interested by the industry and that's your first time coming across this channel, welcome. Most likely, this conversation will be very, very interesting to you, either from inside the industry looking in or from outside the industry looking at the industry as well. So if you are in those two categories and running global content operation or trying to figure out where AI fits in your serious enterprise workflow, I highly recommend this episode. This one is for you, and let's get into it. Simon, thank you for joining me. I really appreciate it. Good to have you on the show.
Well, it's a pleasure. Finally, at last, we get on the show together. I know we've been trying for a little while, but it's my pleasure to be here. Delighted to have this conversation with you, Robert.
Now, as we get going here with the conversation, if you don't mind, everybody on the channel is very interested, and I told me that. The first question seems to be intriguing to a lot of audience because most of the guests, you know, we bring on the channel, probably people are not that familiar with the guests in a lot of cases, so they're very interested in their stories. So the first question is, what is your story? What got you here?
What got me here? Oh my goodness. Great people got me here. I always find that working with great people helps. But look, I studied business and finance. I ended up in telecommunications of all places. That was after a spell in advertising. So I think initially advertising, then I moved into telecommunications. And I ended up working for quite a number of organizations. The one that may be known to people is BT Group around the world. I was a director in BT for many years across various...
That's British Telecom for people, right?
British Telecom, yeah, as it was known then, BT Group as it is now, which was great. I also did a little bit of time working in infrastructure with broadband companies and wireless companies, and actually was part of a team that... We built out Europe's fastest growing broadband company for a time, which we then sold. That was sold privately as opposed to stock market listed like BT is. I also headed up, moved from there into software. And software, as we know, is very global in nature. And it was really there where I suppose my understanding of localization began to develop, my understanding of global business.
That's with Sage, right?
Yeah, with Sage PLC. Yeah, so they're one of the biggest accounting, payroll, CRM platforms on the planet. Huge now in many countries across Europe, the US, etc., and have acquired many companies along the way, millions of customers. So they actually, on the day of recording, they actually announced their results. So they're doing fine, despite what we hear with the SaaS apocalypse. They're doing really well. So from there, I moved into localization, to cut a long story short, and I joined a company called Vistatech, as I'm sure some of our listeners may know. And I've been with Vistatech now for, I don't know, 12, 13 years, something like that. And it's been a great journey because localization industry has changed a lot. What started off, I suppose, as a translation company became a a localization service provider, and I was probably one of the first people to move us to be a global content solutions provider before. I mean, people are only talking about that in recent years, but we've been on that track now for quite a while, and we find ourselves evolving now, obviously, in the world of AI, and we have made some significant inroads there. So I'm sure we'll get talking about that. But that's what brings me here, Robin. So I hope that's okay.
You know, I was just reading your bio, and I did a little bit of research on you. I've known of you. I never met you before. That's my first time. So I had to do some digging in preparation for this conversation. And when I saw that you had a telecom background, I said, okay, so I have a little bit of an intersection with this individual. I've spent early days of my career in telecom as well. And I think at some point I worked with British Telecom on a e-government initiatives. I was working with one of the baby bells here, they call them in Canada, one of the Bell Canada subsidiaries in the Maritimes called Bell Alliant. And we were working on automating everything government is doing back then physically. We're trying to bring it electronically, like driver licenses and all that stuff. So it was pretty interesting for me. So one of the things that, you know, we all, you know, have a trajectory in our life, career, education, people we meet, experiences that we encounter. In your opinion, what, you know, that early on career, education, et cetera, that learnings that you've taken from that, that put you, for instance, and you said, you know, I gotta rely on now in my job today. So because I've done this before, and we've done, I'm not sure if it applies anymore. Some of it may apply, the methodology, the how may have changed. But have you noticed some of the stuff that you've learned early on in the telecom sector as an example that would probably be preparing you for where you are now?
Well, I can make a great comparison, actually. I've been talking about this a lot recently, Robin, that a lot of people in the industry that I'm involved in now, you know, content, language, you know, we talk a lot about multimodal now and AI and, you know, the content explosion. But to me, I draw a parallel with telecommunications because you may recall as well, where originally it was dial-up, and then we got into something called leased lines, and then we got into fiber networks, and then we got into data centers. And then, you know, the telecommunications companies own the data centers, own the initial web farms, as we used to call them. And then we moved from that into broadband, and this thing called DSL came along. I mean, you may recall, we used to call it the information superhighway, and then broadband came along. And things got very, very, very fast, very quickly. And it's a bit like AI coming along into the localization world. It changes. It's a game changer. It's a gear change for the industry. And for some of the incumbents, the big companies, whether they were in Canada or the US or across Europe or the UK, you know, it meant that a lot of their traditional business was changing because a lot of your install base, a lot of ways that you'd made money historically has to change. Because if you think about it, if you're selling lease lines for hundreds of thousands of dollars and you're selling voice services, and then all of a sudden all that stuff can be wrapped in a packet. I'm getting quite into telecommunication speak now, but wrapped in a packet and shipped over a network. That's IT. That's internet protocol, sorry, that's IP. And all of a sudden the business model changes, and you move from, in my software days, you know, I know you asked about telecommunications, but in software I saw something similar to what's happening now, which is when you move from disk-based software that was sold in a box with cellophane wrap on it to being cloud-based. You know, I was responsible for driving cloud worldwide for software through EMEA, parts of the Americas, which is different tax laws, different regulations. But the whole thing moved from being a desk-based type software solution to a cloud-based solution. And that meant a change from people paying annual licenses and now paying a subscription service. And we've seen the SaaS providers, the subscription type businesses now, particularly software, being quite hit at this moment in time. But again, it's just part of the change. And I think the learnings, to answer your question, is there are parallels in other industries that apply very similar to the industries that we're in today. And the people that put the right foundations in, they apply it strategically. They don't just necessarily rush in and, you know, add the word AI in front of everything because it's a buzzword. They think about how this thing works. They provide value to their customers. They understand the difference between providing services to a regulated industry or user-generated content, various industry types. There are lots of parallels in the world. It's just we get very sort of panicked by things. And actually, a lot of this has happened before in business over and over again. How you deal with a challenge, if you turn that challenge into your best business opportunity, that's the learning that I like to take away from my career. This is actually an opportunity for companies to really scale effectively if they harness that opportunity. Unfortunately, some are not going to make it because they're not going to harness the opportunity. They're going to fall by the wayside. I hope absolutely. That's the type of answer you're looking
for. No, very valid, to be honest with you. And you, as you were describing the telecom industry, anecdotally, I'm reminded of the mid-90s when I worked for Genesys. That's the telecom software company for call centers. And at the start of their journey, I guess I worked for them in San Francisco for a while. And I remember I was programming on old platforms. Probably if I mention these platforms now, people will will cry. How old I am? Unix. We're using Unix at the time to do programming. And we're coding, believe it or not, in mid-90s. We were auto-replying to emails. So when we receive an inquiry from a customer, we were looking up that email content or context of the email in the database, formulating email replies, and sending it back to the customer, inquiring about their orders, checking on status, what happened with this issue, what any update on this issue. We're getting these updates in the mid-90s from the databases and sending it back to a customer. So the trajectory we're on right now, and we'll dig into it here in a second, that there's a lot of parallels, but in some ways we're catching up in some things. In some cases, we're still have a long ways to go in some other cases too. So, but you worked for Sage. I mean, this is a very prestigious company, FTSE 100 company, et cetera. What made you walk away from that?
Well, I was there for quite some time. I was very fortunate to be a senior person in that environment. And the business...
You were country manager, no?
Yeah, I was. Yeah, I also looked after the marketing for them. And I also ran the cloud division for part of the group worldwide. So it was an exciting role. It's one of those roles that when you tell anybody about it, it sounds very glamorous, because you're right. They're a FTSE 100 company. They're a huge giant of an organization. And when you work in a company like that, it can be very busy all the time. So you have to have great people around you. But the bottom line is you have to make sure that you're looking after your customer, regardless of the size of the company. What made me go is I'd spent, I don't know, 5 or 6 years maybe at that senior level. I think the year prior to my deciding to move on, I'd spent 50 weeks in the air traveling for business, and I was only home for 2 weeks. Now, that might sound like, oh, you know, I'm not a hardship, but it sounds very glamorous when you explain it to people. But the reality is you spend your time in airports and boardrooms. You rarely see daylight, and it is extremely fast paced. I loved every minute of it. I made great relationships there. I was listening to Steve Hare today, the chief executive of Sage Group currently, with his announcements only today, and what they're doing with the cloud division that I was, you know, part of. It's phenomenal the way their businesses continues to grow globally. And we did an awful lot of work in the US too. So it wasn't an easy decision. But also, you know, I'd already seen the transition from advertising to telecommunications to infrastructure to software, if you like. And because Sage has products and services in lots of different languages and lots of different countries that have an added, like that's a lot for people. Like, companies deal with multi-languages, multi-cultures when they're trying to expand and scale internationally. If you add on the world that I was involved in, you've also got financial regulators, different governments, and different financial rules and regulations in every geography that we worked in. So I was already coming from quite a complex environment. So there was a natural fit into localization. And it got me back a little bit into the content world, which I always loved, back to my early advertising days. And now I'm very fortunate, Robin, because I get to talk to the world's biggest brands who are working on some of the most cutting edge content that you could imagine. So I won't go through the names, but if you think of the world's top couple of thousand companies, at some point we're talking to them, and we work with many of the brands that people know and love today. So I love that, because I don't take that for granted, and it's a great position to be in. And
amazing, isn't it?
Experience with me, you know, and it's great to be able to be there. So you kind of keep your finger on the pulse, but you've still got to make sure that you're rolling out the strategy correctly, that you're growing the business, that you're keeping your costs under control, and that you're, back to what I said earlier, you're actually taking advantage of the change, not being a victim of it, you know?
Amazing, isn't it, that what this industry that we're in allow us to do, specifically on the horizontal side, meaning that cross industries, you're not necessarily siloed in, similar to Sage, I'm assuming you also operated cross industries. That horizontal factor in any industry gives you an opportunity to learn, to broaden the horizon of your connections and the conversation, of course. Now, in 2014, you joined Vistatech. I entered the language industry in 2002, I believe. And again, coincidentally, I was sitting on a plane. I lived on a plane, such as yourself. And somebody sits beside me on a plane from Washington to Toronto, and he convinced me to go work in an industry I didn't know existed. There you go. Fast forward till today. In 2014, you joined Vistatech. Now, you have you've done the round, infrastructure, telecom, software, etc., and you come into the language industry. What is the first thing that surprised you, or what first thing that you said, wow, this is, I can build on this, or my God, they're still here? I should bring them forward a little bit.
Sure, that's a great question, and I haven't been asked that in a while. But one of the things that got me so excited about joining the industry was that Vistatech had a lot of the, I talked about this at the time when I joined the company, and I met with the board, etc. And we were talking about all these building blocks. And in my view, they had great building blocks, but some of them were scattered around. There was a little bit missing over here. But some foundations were there, and I could see this great company that could be built and scaled from here. And that really got me excited about it. It's a little bit like, for anybody who's watching this rather than listening to it, my background is our new headquarters. We always had a large building in Dublin and multiple layers, but we recently moved into this brand new global headquarters. And, I had this vision for the company. I was helpful in driving our move into global content solutions many, many years ago, to stop talking about LSPs and localization and price per word. And we really changed the business to be about providing content solutions. And I know a lot of people do that in more recent years, but we've changed again. You know, I like that being just a little bit ahead. And I think the opportunity was there. Vistatech had built a great relationship. It's kind of the place where people went to when something wasn't working. If you had a real problem, you needed fixing. I liked the fact it was independently owned. I'd been part of a company that was independently owned, and we'd been able to scale significantly, building national infrastructure and selling that company very profitably. And I liked the idea it was independently owned, because I'd worked for, on the infrastructure side, I'd also worked for a couple of PLCs along the way. And there's, various requirements, somewhat restrictive. There's benefits, pros and cons to both. But the fact that Vistatech was independently owned, and still is to this day, it's probably one of the largest still independently owned operations at this moment in time. So it can make decisions quickly, it can scale quickly, and in an agile type fashion. And I found that very attractive, Robin. I found that opportunity really, really good. Now, there was a lot of work. We rebranded it completely. We came out with a whole new look and feel, and we worked on the corporate values and the mission statements and all that good stuff that went into it. But that really set up the trajectory in terms of us growing and scaling. So initially, it was a great question, because initially it was tantalizingly exciting that this was possible. It still is, you know, it's still an exciting opportunity. Yeah.
You know, for me, when I hear you describing it this way, I really appreciate that, because I came from a large corporate world before I joined a small entrepreneur company. That's the plane conversation incident that I mentioned earlier, or accident, or happy accident, I would call it. The fact that you move from a large corporation, which is publicly traded, you've got quarterly annual reports, you've got shareholders, you've got a bunch of restrictions around you. And then you go into, you know, the company I joined, it was like $800,000 Canadian per year. I know the manager, I know the owner. Any decision you want, you just, not committees, not many cycles to make a decision. You just walk into somebody's office. Here's my idea. Do you like it? Yes, no, we'll go back to the drawing board. It was quickly, easy, et cetera. In fact, years later, fast forward, you know, when we joined with Lionbridge, after Lionbridge acquired CLS, you know, the question from Rory at the time, and I were in a board meeting, Rory Cohen was saying, you know, how do you, you know, like, manage to grow as fast? We went from $800,000 to $29 million in 5 years. So how did you manage to do that? And the only thing I can think about at the time when he asked the question is the distance between business and the decision making. If the distance between the decision and the business and the decision making, the customer and the decision making process is short, you've got a much better chance in growth faster. So, and for the audience, VistaTech. So for those who don't know VistaTech, I'm just going to give you a little bit of a detail on that company. It was founded in Dublin in 1997 by Tom Murray, who is a CEO currently, and Pat Kelly, who is the CCO, Chief Corporate Officer, right? CCO, is that what it stands for?
Pat is one of the original co-founders. Tom wasn't one of the original co-founders, but he is our chief executive. He's been with the company an awful long time. Pat was one of the original co-founders. There were five co-founders originally, Robin. Four of them are still there. It is a very flat structure. And we have about 300-400 people managing operations through our global headquarters and across the world. But we also work with about 15,000 to 17,000 people globally, not all at the same time, but various parts of the world on various projects. So, yeah, it grew pretty fast and pretty rapidly. And we've got some great customers. I think one of the things that helped us grow, not just that gap, you know, that shortened gap between decision makers and being able to get things done, which is very different in a PLC or a listed company, was also being able to deliver for large companies. One of the company's original decisions was to go after the largest accounts, to go after the
absolutely
companies, and that's what helped us grow really, really quickly. Because once we'd done a good job with a handful of those, we could continue to do that, and it's still part of the business today. You know, we still win an awful lot of very large organizations, so that helped. And as you were talking, it reminded me of before BT, British Telecom Group. I was also involved in an organization which was a joint venture between BT and a state electricity company on a fiber network. And that was a different working environment. But prior to that, I worked with an Irish entrepreneur who set up what was Europe's biggest telecommunications company. That was originally sold for, going back now, probably $2.5-3 billion at the time. And that was started from scratch in a startup environment. And that was a particularly different way of working. So when, as you have, when you've experienced different ways of working, entrepreneurial startup, we listed that company on the NASDAQ, and eventually it was exited for between $2 and $3 billion. That's an experience. And then you work for a PLC that's been around for a long time. That's a different experience. And, you know, VistaTech is its own experience. But you're right, that advantage of being able to make decisions quickly, fast, respond to customer needs, not be holding to anybody, that there is something good at that. Now, there's pros and cons in every type of business structure. But, yeah, you're right to call that out.
Now, so 30 years, I mean, VistaTech is approaching 30 years. I mean, 1997, we're in 2026. Yeah, almost there, one more year. What do you think the biggest transformation you've seen so far, Simon?
Well, I think the new headquarters, I think, signals our intent for the next 30 years after this 30 years. So we actually celebrate in 2027, it will be three decades in business. And I think our intent is to continue to grow. One of the biggest things that we've seen is AI. It has to be AI, right? Everybody's talking about AI. But we see it, as I was mentioning earlier, as an opportunity to continue our growth. We are very much focused on AI plus human expertise. And when we look at that magic ingredient, that's what our customers need. They need AI they can trust. They need AI that they can stand over. They need AI that's accurate. And they also, a lot of people need a bit of help and advice along the way. And that's why we brought in some consultancy services, which we'd done a little bit in localization around consultancy, but we built a consultancy portfolio. And we weren't the first out of the gate with our AI services. We sat back and we thought about what was going to be important. And, you know, anybody that visits our website can have a look at our AI hub. There's a range of services there now that we specifically worked on to do that. But I think the business is going through more change. The thing that we like about that, we think we've got a bit of an advantage to that because we are very good at changing. One thing that we always do with these global customers is if we're not bringing new things to the table constantly, if we're not helping a global brand change and adapt and move forward, you're just providing a service, and that's not good enough. If you're just providing a service and you're thankful to provide a service, that's not what a company today needs. A global brand, they need a partner they can trust in that's moving the dial, that's progressing their company in a way that's trusted, in a way that they understand, and in a way that actually drives benefits to their bottom line. A lot of people talk good rhetoric around that, as I'm sure you know, Robin. But
I'm sure everybody claims that.
actually do that. There's a lot of hype. There's a lot of hot air. But if you can actually make a difference to a company and show true results, that those companies normally scale. And I'm very proud to say we do a lot of that.
And I do, to be honest with you, I do appreciate the structure that allows you to do this, the structure that allows you to focus the type of focus that you're mentioning right now, because you're not beholden to a private equity firm. You're not beholden to, you know, what the stock market says and how you're going to be driving your business. You're more beholden to develop good relationships, build upon those relationships. I really appreciate that because, you know, for entrepreneurs, and I just started my own small company consulting firm and 49 networks a few months ago, 6 months ago now. And now I'm starting to feel this is where the most valued investment that I can put in is in building these relationships out there. I always done that like all my career, but you're always beholden to corporate. You're always beholden to what the others are thinking, how they want to drive strategy. You know, today we're here, tomorrow we're there. But when you and you know, this is the thing with language industry. It is not a commodity. It's not. We're not selling chairs, tables, etc. It's built on trust, on relationship building. I've dealt with a lot with all my life with salespeople that they, you know, they just come in and all of a sudden, you know, they're presenting a pitch deck to somebody. And I'm thinking like, you got to build the relationship first before you get there. You got to get to know these people to understand how you custom what you want to talk to them about eventually. And so going back to that point, in 2026, this is just recent, in March, when you mentioned AI, there was an announcement around XDM and Vista Tech partnership. Can you speak a little bit to that and how is that going so far?
Yeah, that's another great point. We have relationships with many companies, XDM being one of them. And Lorcan Malone, interestingly and purely coincidentally, Lorcan Malone is the chief executive officer of XDM. And Lorcan and I work together in Sage. So it's a small world. Lorcan was...
reconnecting with an old colleague. That's not a bad thing.
He was on the same flights I was. So Lorcan understands. And we were both knee-deep in the software industry for many, many years. We both sat around similar boardroom tables. So it's just pure coincidence that Lorcan is now the chief executive officer of XDM. And we like what XDM do. We've been working with XDM for many, many years, as we have to do. But one of the things as well, and I want to also mention companies like Phrase, because we're very close with Phrase and a lot of the people there that we deal with. So we have partnerships with many companies. So we have to work with an ecosystem. And I think this is something that a lot of companies have maybe not embraced. We've all kind of been enemies or frenemies or competitors, you know. And the bottom line is that in telecommunications, you have to work with networks of people and networks of companies.
Suppliers.
And I think the localization industry is not waking up to that, but starting to realize that, to your point, relationships don't just mean the relationships with your customer. They mean relationships with your industry peers, providers, partners. So you'll have seen announcements not just with XDM, but with Phrase, with Lingoport, with many of what we would traditionally have called the tools providers. But their business models are changing fundamentally. They're becoming a lot more cloud-enabled. They're providing ecosystems of their own. And Vistatech is integrating with their products and services, because ultimately customers decide. You might find that, I'll give you one example, a customer needs a localization service provider or Vistatech at the back end, but they need somebody that can do human checks for regulated industries. Life sciences is a great example. It is mandated that a human must be involved, regardless of what the AI can do in many of the life sciences areas. So you need workflows in an AI environment where you can decide what content gets sent where, how many times a machine checks it, how many times a human expert checks it, how that's documented, how that's organized, how that stands up to being audited. All that stuff is really important. And, you know, we're working hard with companies like XDM and others to provide that service. And we have a number of partnerships. We work very closely, not just with industry partners, but we also work with governments around the world. And we work with industry communities too. We actually have a full partnership program that works across different types: industry partners, governments, and also communities around the world. So we find that to be very productive, and we do a lot of that work behind the scenes. It's not just that we do some kind of structured campaign for a customer. It's more than that. It's integrating at a technical level, and that's really exciting.
Now, a lot of people hear about the global content strategy or global content service provider, etc. Can you explain, for those who don't know or have misunderstanding or don't have a vague idea of what that is, what's the difference between that and actually providing a transition services?
Well, the difference is, if I go back to my advertising days, it's a bit like Madison Avenue. And advertising was where the ads got made. You know, you had the copywriter, they come up with the content, they designed everything, they thought it through, they had their, you know, test groups, they really thought about it. You know, they were paid to think pretty mm-hmm. much and come up with the winning line. And, you know, the whole TV, media, advertising, radio came out of that, newspapers, magazines. And it was very successful for many years. Now, in an online environment, analytics are instant. You can figure out how things are working. I was recently at the Google Marketing Live event with a lot of the senior people at Google, where now you can just talk to an interface about the content that you have, about your assets, and about how you need a certain campaign to work, and how all the tools will do it for them in an agentic way. Sorry for the buzzwords, but it truly is. That you can just talk to it now. A lot of coders that I talk to today, they're talking to an AI to actually code. They're not physically coding themselves anymore. They're providing the knowledge to oversee the outputs, but they're actually coding using their voice, which is, I mean, you couldn't have imagined this a few short years ago. But to come back to your question, in terms of content, it comes down to this essence. content has to make an emotional human connection. So if you're not connecting with a human, if it's, you know, robots aren't going to buy cars, you know, nobody's going to be, you know, robots don't take out mortgages, at least not at this stage. So humans ultimately are the people that you have to connect with and resonate with, whether that's to make a business deal, whether that's to shift a product. And so if you understand that global content moves the needle, now that might be compassion, it might be commerce, it might be awareness, it might be information, it might be helping people survive in disaster areas. It can be lots of different types of content. And whether it's, we categorize it real simple, right? It's the written word, it's audio, and it's video. And there are thousands and thousands of platforms where that happens. And then you've got content that a corporate company produces, content that a small business produces, content that a solo entrepreneur produces. Then you've got user-generated content, and that goes across every industry in business. So global content solutions, multimodal AI inputs, and understanding how you use your content assets is really, really important. But back to Madison Avenue, it's not enough for a company to say, well, we translate that stuff, or we localize that for you, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, Vistatech does a lot of that work. I'm not saying we don't. But more and more, we're involved in helping create that content. We're helping to shape that content. And that's a flywheel effect, because you find yourself moving into content production, not just a post content production activity, which is what localization and translation pretty much has been, whether that's from a cost perspective or seen as a cost center or a post activity that happens once somebody's come up with something that they need. We work a lot with companies too that are trying to scale internationally, and they're trying to go into new markets, right? As do a lot of our competitors. But one of the things that we can show is, here's how we've applied various media types. Here's the stuff that we come up with on behalf of a client, and here's how it worked, and here are the analytics on the back of that. And this is why they work with us. And I think that's a real important step change when you're talking about global content. It's not enough to say, send me your content, we'll translate it. That's table stakes, as they say. That's, you know, I mean, AI is taking away the commodity of that business, right? Anybody who's still in the price per word game is in a losing industry. Global content is much richer than that. It is the exciting space where storytelling, communications, and emotional engagement happen. And that's where we're playing more and more, Robin.
So speaking of content, and there was the, you know, as you know, there are several categories of content. There's internal facing, external facing. Enterprises have many needs, obviously, for content. You know, could be for their own internal HR, could be for customer facing, advertisement, publication, variety of things. And I'm assuming you mean like the strategy that you're talking about, variety of content, could categories could be treated in a different processes or different models, if you will. I want to validate that. And plus the AI, that the AI in general, you've watched this industry move around from early MT to neural networks, generative AI, and now we're dealing with what we're dealing with. And obviously the word AI is a bit redundant nowadays. But what has generally shifted the conversation that we're having in 2026, for instance, versus, you know, even 3 years ago, 2022, 2023?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head. We've been working in MT and neural MT for a long time. Like, this is, AI is not news to anybody who's been at the, you know, the cutting edge of localization, right? I mean, machines translating stuff is old news. However, I think companies are realizing that it's not straightforward, and it takes a little bit of know-how. And we're seeing that in the software industry too, just as a parallel, where, yes, you can probably figure all this out yourself if you've got unlimited time to focus on something, but businesses don't. You need a trusted partner that can actually work on this stuff for you, that know what they're doing. Your point about the different content types, Absolutely. Within any industry of any, sorry, within any company of any size, there's internal and external communications. There's a plethora of different requirements. And you can't just treat that the same way, because guess what? With our AI friend, it doesn't necessarily give you the same answer. So you need to understand the workflow that you need, where you augment the human and where you don't, where you can apply AI successfully and where you really shouldn't. And part of redesigning global content for people is not just about the content and the engagement that I was talking about earlier. It's about having a workflow, a structured workflow that actually delivers and that is checked on a continual basis. So it's not just continual localization where you're dealing with thousands of jobs a day for a particular client, you know, hundreds of thousands of jobs a quarter for a particular client, all different content types. It's about how each of those are treated. And that's why, back to that ecosystem, working with partners that provide tools and services, we've always been, if I was talking to our CTO, Phil, today, you know, Phil would have spoken an awful lot about our technology agnosticism, meaning if something's available and we can bolt it on, of course, we'll go out and include it in a service. But we found ourselves as well building more and more bespoke services for customers. One of the products or one of the services that we have is called Vistatech AIM. It's a bespoke proprietary AI tool that we have for managing everything from finances to workflows to human experts around the world dealing with hundreds of thousands of projects at any moment in time for a particular client. So to what exactly to the point that you're talking about, Robin, you can't treat everything the same in a human environment, in an AI environment, or in a human and AI environment. But luckily, we're at a point in our time where we have the tools to do that. A lot of people talk about the word orchestration, and it really is down to making sure you have it set up right, that it's tested, that it's auditable, that you can stand over it, and that it can be proven. And I think that's the difference between people that talk about AI and people that actually use AI effectively. So I hope I'm answering the question there.
No, you did. No, absolutely. There's another point I'd love to run by you, speaking of content. Many companies out there are using the term output scoring, content scoring, whatever you want to call it. Some people call it differently. But basically, the idea, the basic concept is, after we localize the content, did it achieve the intended goal or objective? Have you gone into that on your side at Vistatech, and how does that working out?
Yeah, we have. There are traditional tools out there that people have used historically for content scoring or localization scoring. We actually developed our own scoring too. So we have a Vistatech scoring tool, and that has been very advantageous for companies, because some people have different opinions on some of the scoring tools. I won't name any names and how accurate they are and how good they are. You're laughing because you know what I'm talking about.
I do.
So we decided there was room for us to also provide a score dashboard, if you like, a tool that can actually make sense of this. It doesn't mean we run that only, and it just because we developed this, it doesn't mean that it's favorable to us. But it does produce real live results for people to be able to see what's working, what's not working, what needs to be improved on. And of course, as you know better than anybody, Robin, when you're meeting with these global brands, typically on a quarterly basis, and you're reviewing that type of quality score, we've always found it useful to have more than one metric when we're talking about that, more than one provider providing the checking. I think what's also important, though, is because we are so embedded now in a lot of our accounts at the results orientation of what they're trying to do. So what is the result that you're trying to manifest? What are you trying to deliver? And we would often design bespoke measurements with a customer that says, okay, if your primary goal is to do A, B, and C, we're going to be able to measure A, B, and C and show back to you D, E, and F statistics against that on a quarterly basis, on a half yearly basis, on an annual basis. And so we're measuring exactly what we signed up to deliver, which is more than, well, hey, we did the translation, we did the localization work, we sent it back to you. Best of luck. Hope everything goes well with that. Yeah. We did a good job. We know we did.
Our job is done.
The fact that your content doesn't work or it didn't drive the needle for you, I don't think that's enough of a handoff, right? And I see companies that are still doing that. It's crazy. But I think the industry's changed, and I think people want a partner who's committed, there with them for the journey, and working with them to deliver the favorable outcomes that they're trying to drive. And by the way, the outcomes change constantly. It's a fast-paced, exciting environment. That's kind of how we approach scores. They are important. They're not the only thing, because the bottom line is, did we move the needle? Did you drive revenues? Did you drop more profit to the bottom line? I know I'm being a little bit broad strokes there, but ultimately, are we achieving what we set up and agreed initially we were trying to achieve with you? And how can we get there faster, more efficiently? What can Vistatech bring to the table to help you drive your global ambitions more effectively?
Now, it's very interesting, because I see two categories of customers out there. One is, you know, I want to translate or I want to localize because I'm being asked to localize, because either by policy, if you happen to be government, you know, I checkboxed the form, it's translated, leave me alone, I've done my job. Or you've got the second set of customers where translation drives revenue. And the third category of customers where you probably need to convince them that by translating or localizing your content could drive more revenue. And I think as an industry, and I don't know if you agree with me, I think that I've made a couple podcasts on this one. As an industry, we need to do a better job on selling the idea that by translating, you are going to drive revenue. That's not an expense. It's an investment in future revenue. And I think a lot of miss there, I don't know, but I've talked to many people. So, you know, I mean, I was just talking to a manufacturer here in Canada, I don't know, a few months ago now. They export to close to 100 countries. And I said, oh, don't you need your material facing, customer facing material translated? No, they all speak English. They speak English where? Not you probably, for you probably do. For the other guys, probably they can order a beer in English. I'm stretching it. But they probably can't read a technical manual and make comprehension of it, right? This is where it becomes a little, you're right, measuring the outcome and connecting it to a revenue, it's important to a category of customers. But there are certain categories of other customers that still need some work around that. Bring them along.
Yeah, I like what you're saying, because just because you can speak a language doesn't mean you buy in that language. And as we know, if you can put something in the language that that person grew up with, learned to speak as their first primary language, your chance of conversion is much higher. And, you know, unfortunately, if that message hasn't got through to the organization, Robin, we'd love to talk to them, because we can certainly help in that environment. And I think, look, it's part of the reason why we brought in consultancy services, because some people, they actually need help in this environment. And they don't just need help, meaning they don't know what to do. I don't mean it that way. I mean, a lot of people that have to drive revenues or drive sales or move a business into a different international geography, they're often tasked with delivering something, and they may not have enough people. They may not have enough expertise. And that's why I think consulting comes into it. And it's great to hear about your own consulting business too, because people ultimately need that trusted partner that I was talking about earlier. Somebody that can say, well, actually, this is what you need. And also, we find an awful lot of people need a little bit of help talking back to the C-suite to explain to the C-suite and the key stakeholders in an organization, this is actually why this stuff's important. That doesn't mean justifying localization spend or, you know, convincing people to spend more money. It actually means mapping the capabilities, whether that's AI or other, into a multilingual opportunity. And how does an organization make a multilingual operational reality in their own organization that delivers visible, tangible benefits? And I think without a defined, framework or a global content approach to that, or trying to do that in isolation where maybe they've lost a little bit of headcount, or maybe they don't quite have the expertise, or maybe they've been promoted into a role and the task is just overwhelming. We find that our consulting services help an awful lot there. And we're finding more and more, of course, we're consulting a lot on AI, but just overall strategy and development for workflows and localization and compliance is huge. Regulation is huge. That workflow orchestration I was talking about earlier. But sometimes, you know, key decision makers and stakeholders, they don't know what they don't know. And sometimes you need to help them to get more information quicker that can actually help their business. There's nothing better than proving that and showing them, well, this is what we did here, so this is what we think you guys need to focus on here. And I'm just going to make a bold statement here. We've often, not too often, our chief executive will be pleased to hear, but we've sometimes said to companies, we're not going to go down that road with you because we don't think that's the way you're going to succeed. And I can count them on one hand where a global brand has been shocked by that statement. And we've actually gone on to actually win that business in a short period of time because they've actually come back and said, you know what, you were right. We tried this, it didn't quite work out, and that's why we're back talking to you. And that has been a more fruitful relationship to be, you know, you need to be bold in doing that because you're talking about millions and millions in revenue every quarter that you're saying, hang on, we don't think that's kind of the way you need to go about that. And if you change your mind on that, or if you'd like us to talk about that a bit more, we're here for you. But the way you're trying to approach this, we don't think you're going to get the best result from it. And that's coming from, you know, a really good place, 3 decades of experience, and people that are at the cutting edge of bespoke AI solutions. I'm not saying we get it right all the time, but we get it right a lot of the time. And sometimes, occasionally, we have to say, hang on, there's a bit of information that you're missing here. And that's not an easy conversation, but our consultant services help an awful lot there, and they help set the playing field, if you like, where people at least can make an informed decision, whether they choose to go with us or somebody else, they can make an informed decision.
And trying to understand what's real, what's not real. And, you know, I'm not sure if you noticed the same thing, but when I initially started, you know, years ago in the industry, my conversation at the C-level was, when you talk to a C-level 20 years ago, you would think, you know, they don't know if they do translation, they don't know if they do localization, they don't know if they even have a department that does that stuff. I'll check on that one, I'll find out for you, you know, those are the type of answers you get. Nowadays, I think the C-suite are a lot more educated at what localization is because, you know, the many voices in the industry has grown. We're a lot more out there educating on various levels that could be good or bad, I guess, in a lot of cases. But what I'm noticing now that when you talk to the C-level, they're listening to the localization industry. That's fine. But they're also listening to Silicon Valley. And Silicon Valley's message is we've solved the language problem. I mean, this is everywhere now. I mean, you know, all you have to do is just do a little Googling on AI and language, and they tell you, oh, we've solved the language problem. Meanwhile, the industry is saying, hang on a second, you haven't solved it. And, you know, you're still requiring 4 to 6 eyes on every piece of content if it's important to you, specifically in life science. And I love what Karen, I can't pronounce her name, Kachik, your director of sales for life sciences, you interviewed her on your podcast. You know, you're required for 4 eyes, required for compliance reasons. And there are some compliance issues that you need to worry about. And you cannot run things through, oh, yeah, we've solved it. We're just going to put it through a machine and it comes out translated on the other end. How are you managing all this on your side?
Yeah, not just Karen. Karen is great. She works with many others in our life sciences division. That's something we invested heavily in a number of years ago. We've always been in life sciences, but we really scaled up our life sciences operations because we do a lot in technology, and that brings us into fintech and financial technology. And as you know, that's heavily regulated too. And those regulations aren't the same. You know, it's back to my software days in Sage, you know, where accounting standards, tax compliance, governments were different. Exactly the same in life sciences and finance industries. They have regulations that differ depending on where you are on the planet. And To your point, you need four sets of eyes on something. You must have a human checking it. They must be an expert. And there's many examples like that where people are realizing that. Now, I find that the middle layer in an organization typically get it. They understand the complexities and nuances. The downward trend, at least that we've seen over the last couple of years, is a lot of downward pressure from C-suite to move to an AI model because it reduces cost. Surely Silicon Valley is telling us this is all sorted out, and why are we still spending these kind of funds? But the challenge there is that there's a bit of a learning curve, because as we know, it isn't all easily done that way. Will there come a time where that's the case? Yeah, I'm sure there will, but it's not going to be here in the foreseeable future. There's an awful lot of complexity and compliance that's required. And obviously, we all know the horror stories where a brand gets something wrong.
And oh, yeah.
It's been machine translated and everybody goes, oh, that's great. We saved a bit of money there. And then all of a sudden, they've got a corporate issue on their hands and they've got their global PR teams having to deal with something and to put a few fires out around the world. That stuff is not healthy for a brand. So I think it's a combination of having a partner you can trust, working on the compliance side, making sure your data is clean too, because a lot of people talk about having data lakes and the right data, but a lot of it is not in a good condition. So we work with companies to make sure that their data is right. And then there's a difference between, as you know, Robin, public models and private models. And, you know, that's a very different decision for companies, and there's costs involved in all this. You know, it's not just,
correct,
well, I'm using Gemini or ChatGPT or Claude, or, you know, I'll just put it into that will fix everything. Very rarely works out like that. There are huge cost savings, of course. There's huge efficiencies, of course, but not without the checks and balances. And, you know, I don't know many global brands that are succeeding in that environment. You need AI. Of course you do. It's fundamental to the future. But you need humans, you know.
And, oh, 100%. This is where the value gets added, right? So yeah, by that, you know, adding that professional thoughts and input into the models that you spoke about, it's very interesting, because most people think I'm handing it over to a robot and it gets it done on the other side and, you know, everything's fine. But that's not the case. That's not the case at all nowadays, because there's a lot of room for errors. I mean, 2 years ago or 3 years ago now, I can't remember how long ago, driving through Montreal and the main highway going into the city, I see a huge billboard ad, and the word goat, that's was done back then during the football championship, the global world championship. And they were referring to goat as greatest of all time. And meanwhile, it was translated into French into a goat, an actual goat, four-legged goat. It was nevertheless, a huge company in Canada is Hudson Bay Company. I shouldn't have named them, but here you go. But they're on a billboard. I mean, it was in the media. I'm not breaking any news here. There you go. You made the wrong translation on a billboard. What can I tell you? The idea is, again, there's a lot at risk, and it's like buying an insurance policy. Why do I need insurance? I don't know. You may get into an accident. I have no idea. Perhaps you don't, and I hope you don't, but you may get into an accident. You need an insurance policy.
Well, two things, Robin, that spring to mind. Number one is the future of business is localization. And I think more and more people are getting that message. And the other thing that I want to mention is that ultimately, when it comes to AI, it's the tool to help you be more efficient. So yep. If you're spending a lot of time talking about and using AI, but it's not actually driving your business, you're doing it wrong. So working with a trusted partner takes away that pain. If you don't have the time, the energy, the inclination, or you can't get it to do what you need to do, paying somebody who can do that for you using AI tools is your best course of option, because then you can spend time focused on your business and what you're good at. So I think in the same way, companies, you know, a lot of companies decided it doesn't make sense for us to hire a lot of linguists and, you know, localization and translators around the world. There are companies out there that can do this for us. The same way people are now trying to do their own AI in inverted commas and realizing, well, yes, we could keep doing this and I can keep adding people and trying to figure out I mean, every time you open your computer, there's another model, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
So it doesn't stay still. Am I better off just moving to a model where my partner looks after all this stuff for us and I don't have to really worry about that? It just works. And I think it's a little bit like the Apple, you know, it just works. Just turn it on and it works. You know, when you use your Google products and services, you don't have to worry. Well, typically you don't have to worry that your Gmail is going to turn up, or you can go to Google Drive, or, you know, you don't go to Gemini and go, it's not there this week. You know, it doesn't happen. So the same way in the localization and translation world, I think people more and more are going to migrate to, well, who's the provider, who's the partner that we can just trust to get this done? And I think we've got a good chance of being that partner.
That's right. That's right. And you know, like the old saying used to say back then, and I think we can convert that into today's age as well in any way you prefer. If you think hiring professionals is expensive, try hire amateurs. It's pretty interesting when people complain how expensive things are, and then the damage control after that, if they go the easy way or the cheap way to get things done, they end up with a much bigger problem to fix, in my opinion.
Yeah. And working with a partner who specializes in a workflow for a particular industry niche or sector, I think that is a really important area. And we've seen some people being able to take the pain away from a user and say, look, we got this. Work with us. This is how we're going to treat it. This is how it's going to work for you. And again, you've still got to deliver the outcomes. You've still got to be able to show that you're bringing new solutions to the table. But you've taken away the headache of them having to manage all this. And I've seen this time and time again in the software industry, in the advertising industry. You can read so many things on search engine optimization and analytics until, as the saying goes, your eyeballs bleed. You can go down a rabbit hole. AI is probably one of the biggest rabbit holes I've seen. Bottom line is, do we want to keep having to continue on that ourselves, or do we just want to partner with somebody like Vistatech, like Vistatech AI, that can just make this easier for us, that can actually make this work? And I think more companies are seeing the value in that, right? And we're going through a bit of a bell curve where people are trying stuff and then figuring out that, well, this worked last week, but that was two models ago and it stopped working the way, and what we ironed out isn't quite what we thought we're getting now.
Yep.
Now we're seeing more errors. Why is that happening? Okay, we need to talk to an expert here, you know.
That's right.
That's an opportunity for us. That's where we step in, you know.
Man, I can talk to you for a couple of days. This is a pretty interesting conversation. I'm really enjoying this conversation with you, Simon. My last question, if you don't mind, you know, I just realized we're over time here. I didn't know how time flew on this conversation. It's pretty awesome. Last question, if you don't mind, there are people out there in the audience who are running language company, and there are service providers, etc., localization teams, managers, global content operations. They're all trying to figure out like where to stand right now in an AI transformed market. What is the most honest and useful thing you would say to them today? Not the conference version, but the real version, like just give them the real straight talk.
Well, I'm sure people hear the conference version, which is make yourself more valuable, upskill your own AI understanding and knowledge, get involved in it. And there is some truth in that, right? I think people who are shying away from it or not buying it, there are some countries and cultures around the world that are sort of shying away from AI or looking down on AI, but we're not putting the genie back in the bottle, right? That's the conference speech, right? The reality, though, is for people that are dealing with it, ultimately, you need to put your business glasses on. You need to think about it as a business. And, you know, if you own the company that you work in today and you were trying to move forward, what are the things that you would want to work? What are the things that you would want to drive? Where would you need some help? What do you think are the problems that are slowing you down, that are stopping you from going faster? What's the thing that if you unlock that would generate greater revenues? What's the thing if you unlock that would reduce costs? What's the thing if you unlock that would produce better profitability? What's the thing if you remove that would take away that barrier? And I think an awful lot of the time, people, you know, you can fall into the trap of saying, well, I just work here. Like, I get paid to do what I do. But you've got to put your business glasses on. You've got to say, okay, well, if I was the person that owned this business and I'd got you working for me, what would I really want you to be doing? And sometimes I think the advice is to have an honest conversation, whether that's with your line manager, whether that's with the C-suite, whether that's with the key stakeholders, and say, look, what are the three or four things we need to be focused on to help us move faster, more efficiently, more profitably, and have a better business? And I think if you start there, Robin, you get back to the job that you're doing today anyway. But a lot of people aren't mapping that part of the discussion back to the job they do today. Mm-hmm. And you can say, well, it's not my job, right? I don't sit on the board, or I'm not a shareholder, or I'm not, you know. I don't get paid enough for that.
You've got to play a role.
The bottom line is the business is transforming. It is not going to be the same today, and it certainly isn't going to be the same tomorrow. So you've got to put your business glasses on. You've got to think, like, what are the things that I should be involved in? You've got to migrate towards that. And sometimes companies that do that, the good thing is when you get smart humans together, you don't need many of them to make a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
All right. You then add a small team of the right people together and you give them AI capabilities. Those people can move mountains.
100%. 100%. I really appreciate it. And for the audience, you know, for those listeners out there, listen, you don't need, you can't possibly do it all yourself. There are so many things that you need to think about or do that you probably need outside help for this. You know, you may think, oh, you know, the last time I downloaded an Apple app and it worked and it's fine. This is a little bit, a lot more complicated than this. And your IT department may need to seek some outside support, consulting, figuring out together. You know, I run an AI exchange networking on Friday morning at 9 o'clock Eastern for people who are interested. And this is where we sit down and we try to get an update on the latest and greatest of what's going on in the world from a technology progression perspective, and from what use cases people are seeing in the market, how are they deploying it? What are they working with? And it's pretty interesting because every week I know I learn something new. Every week there's something new happening. So there is no possible way one individual, the CEO, CTO, CIO, it doesn't matter who that person is, can have every piece of the pie or piece of the puzzle that you need to put together a full picture of what's going on out there. Talk to people, consult, seek help. And you'd find it very, very surprising. People are all willing to help. People are all willing to step in and say hello to you and support you on your journey. Simon, I want to thank you so much for this. That was great.
It's my pleasure. And thanks for having me here. It's been great to talk to you. If people want to get in touch, I'm easy to find. Put my name into LinkedIn, do a quick search. You'll find me. There's no problem. Thanks so much. It's been great to talk to you. I hope it has been a useful conversation for you.
Oh, absolutely. An hour and 10 minutes almost. I didn't realize it went. It's been genuinely rich conversation. I really appreciate it. And I think from the viewer's perspective, you've given them like a rounded view of the industry from inside of one of the industry's best companies out there. And I want to thank you so much. If somebody wants to get a hold of Simon Hodgkins and you can't find him, I'm connected with him on LinkedIn. Reach out to me. I'll facilitate an introduction. No problem. And if this conversation is interesting to you or you've found it useful, feel free to share it with somebody that you might think would be interested to them. And at the same time, I want to thank you guys for watching us on YouTube. If you come in on our audio channels, thanks for listening in. And if you're checking us out on the blog, thanks for reading the blog where I summarize all these conversations into one small article where you can spend a few minutes and read what Simon and I talked about today. Until next time, I see you at the next episode. Thanks so much, everybody.